Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Unsung Heroes. Unsung Heroes. Unsung Heroes. Unsung Heroes.
Hi, you're listening to Ricky Wilde, and this is Unsung Heroes. Thanks for tuning in, guys. It's lovely that you're here. I know you're going to be fascinated by this week's episode. Steve Anderson, what an incredible man, is the MD of Kylie's band and behind pretty much everything she does. He's an incredible talent, amazing remixer as well. He was with Brothers in Rhythm back in the day with Dave Seaman. All over everything, remixed everybody, has worked with pretty much everyone you can think of. And yeah, just all-round incredible talent and a beautiful guy. And it's so lovely to see him again after all these years, because obviously he'd remixed a couple of Kim's tracks back in the day. So yeah, unfortunately, Jakey couldn't make it with us because he had a filming schedule that he had to fulfill. But me and Lee managed to pin down the amazing Steve Anderson. Steve Anderson, welcome to Unsung Heroes.
Thanks, Ricky.
How fantastic to have you here.
Oh, listen, it's lovely to be here. It's great. I love this studio.
And so lovely that you travelled up to see us as well.
That so close to me.
It's just lovely for us because we can just set up all the mics and it's in a nice, quiet environment. So it's lovely for us. But
totally.
It's lovely that you came. Thank
yeah,
you
no
so
worries.
Much.
Unsung Heroes is all about, people that in the music industry, lots of people know who you are, all the Kylie fans know who you are, but it's great to hear about all the stuff that you do behind the scenes, bringing to life artists, songs, stuff that really resonates with the public for sort of 20-30 years or so. So we really want to talk through all the stuff that you've done, from writing, producing, being a musical director, yeah. And understanding what makes you tick and what you like. I certainly know my I chat with you on Twitter quite a bit. And
yeah,
much
definitely.
Like Ricky, you're a real advocate for new music, constantly looking out for the next great new song. So I think we've got loads to talk about.
Definitely. And for me, it's really interesting to see how other people work, because there are no rules with being an MD, and there's so many different aspects to that
particular
skill, talent. First of all, you've been doing the orchestral stuff recently, the 80s.
Yeah.
How did you translate all those songs the way you did?
Well, that one was I worked with an arranger for I've worked for a long time with an arranger called Cliff Masterson, and a few years back we started doing a couple of shows, one in Ireland and one in Leeds, separate shows which were similar in concept to the Pete Tong dance shows, but more about the particular clubs. So the one in Northern Ireland was for the club Lush, so it was their biggest tunes, and then the one in Leeds was for the club Back to Basics. So it was different, completely different sets. But it was effectively dance music, which is kind of my background from years ago. I came up through dance music, mixed with the orchestral side of it. And then a couple of years ago, Cliff and I got to thinking that concept would work really well with 80s, big 80s songs. Mm. And we were just really lucky. We went along, about 2 years ago, we went along to a little Pizza Express show that Howard Jones was doing, which was just him and piano. Mm. And we just said to Howard, look, we're thinking about doing this thing. And he was like, yeah, that sounds good. And he was the first to sort of say yes. And then after that, we were able to talk, got everybody from Nick Kershaw and Jimmy Somerville, and this year we've got this year we're touring with Belinda Carlisle and Howard again, and and the whole point of that was those catalogues of songs, as you know very well because you wrote a lot of them, and they set themselves up perfectly for a symphonic arrangement because they've got all the chords and they've got all the powerful things. You can do so much with intros.
Yeah.
You know, the way 80s classical works is we wanted to have the best of both worlds, and which is why we kind of have a programmed element of it. Mm. Having a live drum kit on a stage with 80 live mics is difficult anyway.
Yeah.
So I wanted it to... programmed wise to sound have the same kind of impact with those big snares and everything.
Yeah. Were you using samples and
so everything's like redone from scratch basically. Yeah. So we will reprogram it. So I will do what I kind of call a remastered supersized version of the original. So because I think the orchestration is a lot, is enough for people to take in. So I want it to have that feeling of, oh God, I remember this song, but it to still sound big.
Yeah.
We could do it with a drummer playing pads, but there's so much going on that stage anyway.
Yeah,
you know. So
how many on stage? Is that 80?
There's 70 or 80, usually. So this tour we're doing this year is with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
Amazing.
And that's doing arenas.
And what a buzz for you that must be when you see that.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really... I've been so lucky, even from an early age, when I first started making records, I don't know what it was, but people, you know, trusted me with strings and orchestras, and I've worked with incredible people. And I've just become I'm quite used to being around orchestras now, and I push them quite hard to do interesting things.
Yeah.
But yes, our whole point with 80s classical is there are shows like that happen with other people singing, and that's fine, but we really wanted it to be the original artists.
Yeah.
And to be the kind of people that we were huge fans of.
Yeah.
And that the material would translate really well.
Yeah.
So,
and I think for them it's a lovely experience because they're listening to those songs that they've written and been a part of for so long.
Yeah.
In such a different way. And it must be a real buzz for them as well.
Yeah, I think so. And also we tried to pick people that hadn't necessarily had that before. People, you know, artists like ABC, for instance, who are brilliant, but they've done a whole Let's Kind of Love That Anne Dudley did. And people that hadn't had shows like that. And I think a lot of the 80s acts... you know, through Kim and yourself and everybody, there's a certain kind of show that is brilliant that they're used to doing, which is either the rewinds and stuff like that, which is fantastic in a field and stuff. But this just felt a bit different, I think.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, not better or worse, just different. And because of that, I think they were really intrigued. And it was a collaboration all the way through. We were sending them stuff and saying, this is what we want to do.
Mm.
Put it all in Sibelius, make sure they liked it.
Yeah.
They would suggest changes.
So that's what you did. You programmed it all first.
And everything was programmed,
And it was like just played all the orchestral parts were played.
Everything
with
was
samples.
In, yeah.
And then you just presented it as if it's going to... This is roughly how it's going
to sound. This is, sort of like a demo, a reference demo of here's what we'd like to do.
Yeah.
And they would come back and sort of say, well, actually, I mean, a lot of
you did that with Cliff, did you?
With Cliff, So a lot of people have certain things that they always do live and have done for 15 years. Like there's a bit that's always a breakdown.
Yeah.
Or there's a bit that weren't on the originals.
Yeah.
So it was really important for us to, with the original artist, to just send over things. And then they come and say, oh, yeah, we always do this thing. And they send me a reference and we put it in.
Okay.
So before it physically got scored, it had been fully approved by the artists.
Amazing.
So that we knew that there was no one's going to come in on rehearsal day and go, oh, hang on, I don't really like that, because they've already heard it.
Did you ever get nervous or they'd come back and say, hate it?
Well, I don't know. I think there is that. Or sometimes sometimes artists have done a song a certain way so many times that they don't want to do
it. Yeah, they can't hear it.
Because it will trip up. Yeah, Howard's a good example because he's brilliant at it, but he has like four different shows. He has like an acoustic show and I think... So he's done so many different versions of new song.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we went back to the original album version, which I don't know if he's done for a while.
Yeah.
So that was just getting... And he was... A lot of the guys, because you were all so busy, so they're sometimes coming to rehearsal from... a tour,
yeah,
where they've done a a different version.
We touched upon that earlier on, actually, before we were recording, how busy everybody's suddenly got.
Massively,
it's
yeah.
It's just suddenly... You think that whole 80s thing is going to sort of like be a big fad and then maybe just die down, but it just hasn't. It's just carried on and on.
It's the quality of the songs and the material. And, you know, for me, I was, you know, when I was a teenager, I used to, well, both Cliff and I, actually, we didn't know each other then, but we both used to be mobile DJs. And, you know, the half of the stuff in the 80s classical show is my singles box, you know.
Yeah.
The end of my show, I'd play, you know, of my discos, I'd play Never Can Say Goodbye, I'd play Kids in America, I'd play, you know, all those songs would be there. But
that's a good cue for us to ask you about where it all began,
in
terms of, did you always know you were going to work in music? Was it a no-brainer, or...?
Well, not at all.
Musical family?
No, I mean, weirdly, it's interesting, actually. I just had a big birthday recently, and I just turned 50. And there was a few. My mum and dad came out with some. You know, we did a party, and there were some photos and some stories. And I got told this story about the fact that when I was about 4 or 5, which is a strange thing, that I went to. We'd gone to visit somewhere. My mum and dad had taken me to one of their friends, and apparently they'd had one of those old sort of home organs, like a Bon Tempi or something like that. And they were in the middle of a conversation, and they apparently heard me just starting to play things. So that's the first time I'd ever.
Wow.
So then they got me a small keyboard. So I'm basically self-taught. So I played by ear. So from silly early, that's when I'd hear something and I'd go, I'd either play it or I'd work out what it was.
Yeah.
And as I was getting, so my education, because my dad had an amazing record collection, so I would, rather than sort of learning chopsticks or whatever, I'd be listening to Stevie Wonder or Aretha Franklin or whoever and just keep rewinding the cassette and go, what's that chord? What's that chord? What's that chord? You must have done the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was classically trained on piano, but only up to about grade 5 or 6, I think. And then I just got fed up, discovered girls, and then
exactly.
went out the window. But guitar, I was self-taught as well. My dad, obviously, he's played a bit of guitar, and there's always guitars hanging around the house.
Yeah.
So same thing. I used to just pick it up.
You just pick stuff up, don't you?
Yeah.
So was it a natural career choice? Did you think? Did you know?
No, not at all. I just didn't. I was just a normal kid. I DJed, did like youth DJs and youth DJing, and then DJed at an under 16s nightclub. I'm originally from Southend in Essex, so there's a couple of clubs there.
So am I. Well, my dad's family all are.
All right, yeah. So like 06, and there's a club called Chester's, and there's a few clubs, and there's a few DJs there. A guy called Ian Redding sort of took me under his wing, and I ended up doing Saturday nights DJing when I wasn't even old enough to be in the club. And then, sort of cut a long story short, found another guy that I used to work with, a guy called Jason Davis, and we formed this little remixing, mega mixing team called Mixbusters, and just did it in our spare time. I left school, worked at a bank for 3 years, and he had a proper job. And one night we went in, one of our friends, a guy called John Leach from Essex Radio.
I was just about to mention him.
Yeah.
102.6.
That's the one.
The Soul Show with John Leach.
So John is
this is a classic if you live in that part of the world.
And he was such a big supporter. He always used to play our little mixes that we used to do. And he said, oh, look, you know, come into the studio tonight if you want to use the studio. And it had a reel-to-reel and all that kind of stuff. And we just put together this thing, this mix or mega mix or whatever it was, sent it off to a company called DMC, which is Disco Mix Club, and they came back and said, we really like it, we want to put it on. Just started doing more and more for them, and then one day I got a call from a guy called Tony Prince, who's a Radio Luxembourg DJ who owns that company. And
Tony Prince.
Do you remember Tony? Yeah, he's still around, actually. I saw him recently. He's fantastic. He's got his own radio station now. And he just said, oh, listen, do you want to quit your job and come and be a T-boy at the studios?
For
zero money, really, for nothing. It meant me travelling up and back, you know, every day from there. And I was like, yeah, and I quit the bank that day, pretty much, and that was it. So and DMC, for people that don't know, is it was a remix, mega mix service, and would only be for a subscription for DJs. But what used to happen is all the record labels used to send their multi-tracks to people like me, who would have never had a chance of looking at those multi-tracks if I wasn't there, to do DJ-only remixes. So that meant what I was able to do when I finally got around to being able to do my own mixes was I would kind of go into the studio at night and then put on a 2-inch reel of whatever was in.
Wow, how amazing.
So that was...
So you were listening to...
Nile Rodgers or Jamal Lewis or Michael Jackson, or because they had all been sent over.
How crazy.
So like I learned, in a candy store, it sounds like. Yeah.
So I kind of learned how to make records by listening how everybody else made records, isolating all the individual tracks.
Wow. What an education.
Yeah.
How amazing. And what a great thing to have on your CV. You've worked with Michael Jackson, and because essentially you have, because you mixed their stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And we were lucky that, you know, I met, there was a guy called Dave Seaman who I still work with now, and we filmed
Your partner in crime in Brothers in Rhythm.
Yeah, we still had this thing called Brothers in Rhythm, and we started taking the remixing thing a bit more seriously, and people thought that we could produce records, so we got to do that, and do the remixes on Michael and Janet and stuff. And
some of those remixes, can we just say they are legendary remixes?
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Janet in particular, really.
Yeah, well, that was the sort of one of the first times that, because back then, I mean, it's really hard for people to understand this now, but back then the whole idea of speeding up a vocal wasn't like putting it in a computer and going 124 BPM. You physically had to very speed the tape.
Yeah.
And then pitch the vocal back down again. Yeah. It was so mad.
And that was the day of buying CD singles as well. And people would buy a CD single if you were on the remix, in terms of that was like a guarantee of quality in terms of buying a CD single. If you saw there was a Brothers in Rhythm remix, you're like, this is going to be good.
And
you would, even if you had the album, you would buy the CD single knowing you were getting something extra. This is all pre-Spotify and iTunes.
Well, I mean, we always, the one thing that we did quite a lot was that back then in those days in the 90s, and I'm sure Ricky will attest, there was a little more money around in production and budgets and stuff, because records sold a lot. And a lot of people made a lot of money then, but Dave and I would always spend most of it on the actual budget. So all of the remixes you're talking about were all done at Psalm West, which is Trevor Horn's studio.
Yeah, amazing studio.
And we'd be in there for weeks, you know, just book in there and, you know, and just spend two. I mean, certainly things like the Confide in Me house mix, that was 2 weeks in Studio One, whatever it was, you know, however much money a day. Yeah. So we would spend all the budget on making.
There was a bit of a clue there as well, I think, in terms of the sound. When you're talking about like the lush stuff or the orchestral stuff, two of those absolutely, and I don't use this word lightly, classic remixes that you did for Kylie on her first post-PWL album are the long version of Confide in Me and the long version of Where is the Feeling. They've got a real drama, a real cinematic sound, which definitely to me links in to where you went with the orchestral stuff. So it's quite interesting. Early on, someone that's very much, you know, thought of as a DJ and a remixer had a... You weren't just bashing out beats per minute. There was a real dramatic quality to it as well.
Well, that's I think also because as much as I was a DJ, you know, that was the other thing that I would listen to when I got home would be, you know, I'd be listening to, you know, movie soundtracks. I'd be listening to Michael Kamen. I'd be listening to Jeremy Lubbock. I'd be listening to all these incredible orchestrations and dreaming, you know, buying, when I saved up once to buy the first Kirchweil I had, because this guy, Michael Kamen, is an amazing arranger.
The guy who did the piano?
That's
Michael Nyman.
Yeah, Michael Kamen did the Lethal Weapon series.
Yes, of course.
And he did a thing called Edge of Darkness on TV. And it was on a Kirchweil. You remember the Kirchweil strings?
Yeah.
And I found a second-hand one locally for a few hundred quid. And I finally just... this is going back for me and Ricky, but you'd have to spend about... You'd have about 10 minutes, like 10 floppy disks to load in it to make it work.
Make it work, yeah.
But then I'd have an orchestra. And as soon as I had that, I was like, all right. Now we can do anything. So with being at Psalm, it enabled me to layer and layer and layer and layer to my heart's content.
But you also had a hit in your, or at least one hit in your own right as Brothers in Rhythm with Such a Good Feeling.
Which was just a complete mistake. I mean, David...
A happy one, presumably.
A happy one, yeah. David was the youngest ever editor of Mix Mag, which was the magazine that DMC put out. And he won it on a competition, basically, to work there. So he was working upstairs doing this Mix Mag, and I was downstairs. And I wanted to work on the magazine, and he wanted to do music. So we basically did a kind of swap. And just one night, he just said, oh, I've got this idea for this piano riff. And here's a couple of samples. And that's kind of what we did. And it was... The thing about that early 90s as well, that the rave generation, the rave culture, you just, I mean, there was no sample clearance then. You just, yeah, things happen. Yeah, you just shove, yeah, you know, it's the Mars, pump up the volume.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just whack things on. So, and then really, those are the two things we did. There was, they'd wanted us to make a record and make an album, and really it wasn't for us. We just...
Because it took off in the States as well, didn't it? It was like a number one dance, yeah, chart hit on Billboard, yeah, I think.
Yeah, but I just don't, I mean, I've never wanted to be a performer.
Okay.
I think we did one Top of the Pops when we did...
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. We did Temptation. We did a version of Temptation for Heaven 17. Oh, and Dave amazing. And I, because it was, and Dave and I were on Top of the Pops.
I think they still use that version for the live stuff, don't
they? Do
they? I think they do. God, yeah.
I mean, I absolutely love playing. It's so amazing. But, and again, big orchestra on the original.
And
so
what a tune.
What a tune, yeah.
So you're both reluctant to Ricky, we've talked about this
on,
before.
No, he's on stage, though. He loves being, he's a showman, right? I was on Top of the Pops, and I was so scared I nearly fell off the back of the stage and brought half the set down. So for someone that works in my job, like, honestly, being on a stage this day is not my natural
place. But they
were
very small stages, though.
Yeah, but you are, but you on stage, you're a rock star. You can do that thing. It's never been that natural to me to do that, yeah, which is why I kind of immediately realised behind the scenes was the way to go.
I'm not sure I'm a rock star when it went on live, but I try no, pretend to be.
And you've got a guitar as well, so you can give it a bit of that.
You have your moments. Yeah. You have your moments.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, your whistling on the acoustic tour is just absolutely incredible. So naturally, we're kind of leading into the period when you first start to work with Kylie, in terms of, so Kylie had been a big PWL act for many years, and presumably there was a bit of a scrap for who would sign her when she left and who would work with her, and in you come. How did it all come about?
It kind of goes back to, again, when David and I were doing remixes, we were, when she was still at PWL, one of the club promoters over there suggested us to do a remix of one of her songs called Finer Feelings.
Very massive a track.
Which we loved, yeah. Yeah. And it was her first move away from that kind of sound. And don't get me wrong, I'm the biggest Stock Aitken Waterman fan in the world, as I'm sure most people know from what I've done. But they asked us to do a remix on that, which we did, and it ended up being the single version. And then that was the kind of... And I'd done a remix of Step Back in Time, I think, as well. And but honestly, the honest answer is she signed... I know that she wanted to do something different, as a lot of artists in that time of doing their work. Deconstruction were a rogue, punk, brilliant label who we'd done a lot of work with already, and a dance label. And they signed her. And the honest truth is Dave Seaman phoned Keith Blackhurst and said, I heard you sign Kylie. Can we have a go? Can we see if we can come up with something?
Yeah.
And the week later, she turned up at the studio. And we had scrambled around to try and find things. We'd done this kind of up-tempo, housey thing, which was what we thought they'd want. And then we had this really weird breakbeat thing with strings on it and said, we've got this thing. David had scribbled down some lyrics on a pad. And we said, we've got this thing. We think it's called Confide in Me. Do you want to have a go at it? And she did the vocal we were in Studio One, and we tie-lined to Studio Two because we didn't have a vocal booth. And that was the demo that she did, and that's the vocal on the record.
What a song.
Amazing song.
What a song.
And then we went
into a total departure stylistically from where she'd been before. It was such a massive change.
We didn't think, we'd sent it off and went, well, that's not going to go anywhere, because it was so, we imagined a Deconstruction who had, at that time, massive hits with M People.
Yeah.
We thought, they're just going to want to do Hacienda Kylie.
Yeah.
We didn't think they'd want to go. But the whole thing about Deconstruction, which made them so brilliant, is they just didn't care.
Yeah.
They were like, it's brilliant. It's going
pretty
out.
Brave in those days as
massively,
well.
Massively, yeah.
It was such a departure, that song, in terms of... It was so different. It was so different to anything, but so different for Kylie, and her vocal is so different on it as well, in terms of... I think I've heard you say before, you were really keen to bring out something different in her vocally, which you seem to... I think you definitely bring out the best in Kylie. There's something... There must be something in your relationship you've developed from a really early day where she, like you talk about people, you said people trust you. There must have been something there.
Yeah, I think at that time, I mean, that was the very beginnings of when I was working with her. I mean, now it's been a sort of nearly 22 years. Yeah. So we just, it's just like kind of, it's pretty easy anyway. And she is incredibly, you know, she's a, what I call the four take girl. And normally the third one's the one. So there's none of this multiple take stuff. She's always on it. But yeah, I think it was different. And I think she liked that. And we went on to do, you know, other things. But I think sometimes, and for anyone that's, you know, working in this industry, about sometimes when you pitch a song, you know, like back then there was no list of, right, we're looking for, like now writers will get this long list of, well, it needs to be Billie Eilish meets this with a bit of this, a bit of that. Mm. Then it was like, there's Kylie, there's Brothers in Rhythm, what do you want to do? Mm. So we weren't thinking about what was going to work or whether or not it was going to get on the record. And I've weirdly did it since, or a few years later with Britney Spears, where we did two songs. And the one that we went, well, no, they're going to hate that because it doesn't sound like anything they want, is the one they went with. So,
and on that first Deconstruction Kylie album, you've done, there's a song on there which to me is a Bond theme that never was, called Dangerous Game. Which is probably Kylie's, what I think, one of Kylie's best on record vocals as well.
Well, that is also, there's a friend of mine who Ricky knows as well, called Terry Ronald, who's an amazing vocal arranger and producer. And he was in the studio with that, and he got, and there's also all the ad libs on Automatic Love.
Oh, I love that song.
That's very Terry as well. But also, Dangerous Game was weirdly, before we started talking, we talked about a Kim song called Can't Say Goodbye, which is a string arranger called Richard Niles, who did the strings on Dangerous Game. And I just said, it's a Bond theme, go nuts.
It is. Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah. It's amazing. And then on the CD, this is where I start to nerd out, sorry, on the CD single of Confide in Me, there's a beautiful cover of Prefab Sprouts, If You Don't Love Me, which is a beautiful song as well.
Which was literally recorded and in one take as an afterthought, because all of a sudden someone said, oh God, we need a B-side.
It's gorgeous.
And we were in Psalm Studio One mixing Confide in Me. And I just said, oh, and then Dave said, oh, If You Don't Love Me is a really nice song. So I went out, so I listened to it, thought, oh, I can kind of get it. Psalm Studio One used to have, when it used to be there, the piano in it was the Bohemian Rhapsody piano.
Is that what it's played on?
Yeah, yeah. And then we just went in and went, well, it's this. She learnt it, I did it. And then Paul Wright was our engineer then. And I said, I'll just whack the DAT into record. And we just did it. And that's it.
It's a heartbreaker listening to that song now. The way it ends, it's just like the pin drop stuff is gorgeous.
Yeah, but that would literally, again, they would just say, oh God, we need something to put on the other side. And I was like, well, here we go. And again, we didn't really think they'd use it.
I used to love doing B-sides because of that.
Yeah, right?
You have the best B-sides ever.
It's a very strange thing, that your mental state when you go in to record a B-side is a totally different way of thinking. It's very liberating.
Yeah. Can I take this opportunity, therefore, to ask you to gang up on Ricky with me to celebrate the concept of an anti-tour. He's going to glare at me now because I've been working on this notion. So aren't they wonderful anti-tours? For those that don't know that are listening, Kylie did an anti-tour with Steve, which is basically B-sides and album tracks. No hits, really, is the general theme. So they're great, aren't they, Steve?
It was, without doubt, one of the favourite things that we've all ever, ever done.
Really?
It was so wonderful. You can't do that many of them because it's really, really super fans.
Yeah.
They're small venues.
Yeah.
So it isn't, you know, call a break even. Or something to be tagged onto something else. And it's a lot of songs for the band to learn that probably they'll never, ever play again.
Yeah. So it's a full band thing as well.
Yeah. Oh, no, I did it. Even though it was an anti-tour, we did it. We didn't do it as stripped back. We did it as the full thing, programming the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, and there was album tracks, there was B-sides, there were demos. There were songs that had turned up on YouTube from a cassette that I'm the only one that's got. So I don't know how it ended up on YouTube.
Amazing.
And we did it in Australia and we did it here as well.
How did you pick? How do you decide?
It's really hard. I mean, if I'm honest, there's almost enough songs for a second one at some point.
Yeah, my shortlist is really long.
But it's
I've mentioned it to Kimmy, and in principle, she's up for it.
It's a lot of work for a very short amount of dates.
Yeah.
But the joy of it. And also for us, because we were doing, there was, you know, we could actually go into some stuff from the second deconstruction album we made, which, you know, wasn't wildly successful here, was very successful in Australia, called Impossible Princess. You know, we could just go and redo things from there. And Pete Waterman came to the show. Which show did you come to?
I didn't go to the show. No, I wasn't fortunate enough to be there, but I've seen enough.
But you've seen enough, yes. Yeah,
so, and I know the set list everyone I know that went said it was just the most incredible experience to be there. They all say it was just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Pete came to the show in London and he was in tears by the end of it because he was like, how do all these kids know
These random songs
from these albums, you know, because we were doing Always Find the Time and, you know, Over Dreaming Over You. Yeah. And the one we didn't do, which I put on the Golden Tour, was Still Be Loving You, which is my favourite Kylie song.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just get to do all these, you know, and for you, it's going to, because you will have written most of them as well. Yeah, so. Yeah. That's a lot of work, Ricky.
I'm not shy.
You could tag it on. You could do, as part of your greatest hits tour, you could just tag it on to one of the nights.
I think we might be on the way, though, because I think we might have got Kim to think about doing Million Miles Away, which was only a single. It's from the Love Is album, wasn't a single in the UK. And I think that might make it to the greatest hits tour because it's already in the press blurb.
Kimmy is going to come and see us after this interview, actually.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that she'll be able to say hello to you.
Oh, lovely.
So she said, what time do you think you're finished? And I said, well, I'm not sure. I'll let you know nearer the time.
Well, that would be great. Well, of course.
She's only 5 minutes around the corner.
Of course, before the whole Brothers and Rhythm thing, one of my very first ever remixes commercially was on a Kim song. Called Can't Get Enough of Your Love.
Yeah.
Which is an awesome remix. And
Don't have a copy of anywhere. And
actually,
I think I have spent a fair amount of time and money on Discogs, which is a website where you can find quite random stuff to get a CD single or a 12-inch version of it. I think I have it, yeah. I'm trying to remember.
Okay, because someone messaged me on Twitter about it, and I think I've got a DAT somewhere, but
World in Perfect Harmony, which I love.
That's one of my favourite songs.
I have that one, definitely.
What a joyous song. You do that live, right? Have you done that live?
No.
I mean, there we go.
No, never done
what
that.
What a song. Just joy.
I promise this wasn't a setup. I promise. I didn't message Steve before.
It's like Harvest for the World for like a new generation. It's so brilliant. Oh, I love that song.
Well, I have never had the chance to thank you for doing such an amazing job on it.
I just put some beats on it and got Snake Davis to blow sax all over it. That's all I did.
Oh, bless you.
They're great. That pair of remixes is great. They are both fantastic.
You never know, but watch this space. Yeah. Basically, Kim is coming over and we're going to chat with Lee as well about tunes, which ones to do, maybe to add or not. So we'll see.
And, so you mentioned Impossible Princess, which was the second Kylie album, and that was really experimental at the time in terms of taking Kylie in an even further direction away. And people know the Mannix songs probably the most, but there's some great stuff that you did on that record.
Thank you. Well, I mean, we made a 12-track album and then delivered it, and Deacon loved it. And then I think at that point, the big bosses at BMG were like, maybe we need some hits or whatever, which is when they went to the Mannix. And that was great. Those two Mannix songs are really good. But we just kind of...
Very jarring, though, in how they're set.
Yeah, they don't
the
really
album,
fit. I mean, Did It Again was the only one of ours that sort of fits with their sound. But we just decamped down to Real World, Peter Gabriel's studio. And I think Kylie at that point was... I mean, I still stand by the fact that regardless of commercial success, if you go and look at those songs lyrically...
They're great songs.
There's not many pop stars.
Was that Kylie the songwriter at the beginning
absolutely,
of...
Kylie, absolutely, yeah. And we, again, Deacon just went, just no rules, no laws. I mean... We were very into a lot of the kind of sound things at the time, whether it was Massive Attack, whether it was Underworld, Bjork. We wanted to kind of bring all that in
definitely.
There.
Definitely. Yeah.
But
How did Kylie write? How did you write with Kylie? What was the process
very
like?
Different, many different ways, as I'm sure Ricky does as well. It's sometimes we come up and say, well, here's an idea for a track. Sometimes she'd say, here's a title for a song. Say Hey, for instance, she just came in and said, Real World is a residential studio in Bath.
Mm, so lovely, Real World.
Yeah, it's really lovely. And for the demos, we weren't in one of the posh studios. We were in a really tiny little studio. But you all get up and you have breakfast together and stuff. And then she'd say, I've got this thing going round and round in my brain all morning. And then she'd sing the first bit of Say Hey, and we'd just kind of work out what it was. So many, many different ways.
But it's a funny process, songwriting, because sometimes, as you say, it's right across the board. It can be a lyric. It could be you could be laying in bed as you're about to sleep.
Oh, that's killer. That's horrific.
Yeah, so much of the annoyance of my poor missus.
I bet.
It's a very strange thing.
Or walking around a supermarket.
Shops.
You said this on one of the others.
Yeah. You're that, and it's normally mid-song, and you can't do it, and you go, all right, I'm just going to go out, and you're in there, and you're looking at the eggs or something, and then all of a sudden, you find yourself stopping and going, it's that. And then realise someone's looking at you and go, okay, right, I've got to remember what I'm in.
You have to have an iPhone. You have to have your iPhone with you all the time to get those ideas in.
We asked Kim and Rick about this when we met them together, about Kim had obviously done three albums by the time she became a songwriter on the fourth album when she started writing for Teasers and Dares. And we asked her, what was it like? Were you encouraged? Did you feel nervous? Did you have that same scenario with Kylie, who obviously wasn't known as a songwriter? Did you have to coax it out of her?
No, it just absolutely came flowing. And there's an awful lot of stuff, as everybody knows, you need to write a certain amount of not good songs to get a certain amount of good songs. Yeah. So, there's a lot of things about unreleased stuff, especially from around that period. Mm. And I always say the reason that it was unreleased is because it wasn't good enough. Mm. There may be two or three songs that probably have ended up coming out on various things, but you can't always get it right.
Yeah.
And also, you can spend a lot of time making a very average song sound good.
Yeah.
But you could spend a lot of time doing that. And why not just spend that time writing?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A better song.
Yeah.
Or another song.
Yeah.
If I'm working so hard to make a song sound good and make it sound like a record, I feel like I'm wasting my time. I should be writing a song that
just go again.
Need all
start
that work,
again.
What are some of your favourite writing experiences outside of working with Kylie? Who have you enjoyed writing with or for the most?
It's an interesting one with writing with me, because I always say that I'm a writer kind of last, as in I'm not. A lot of my friends are incredible writers who write every day, and because I have I'm lucky enough to, and I have lots of different hats that I put on. If someone says to me, so and so's making an album, have you got any songs? No, I don't have any back pocket stuff.
Yeah,
I just go in and write something for
I'm exactly the same, Steve.
For the I call it kind of bespoke, which sounds a bit whatever, but I have to say, I mean, you're saying outside of Kylie, but I mean, my most memorable recent one was actually for Kylie, which was a song that I wrote with Biff Stannard and Ash Howes and Kylie for the Christmas album called 100 Degrees.
Oh, we're going to ask you about that. That's on our list.
And I know you said outside of Kylie, but it's just that's because it was the middle of August. It was
a Christmas
blisteringly hot. Yeah. And it was about 100 Degrees. And it was literally it happened over, again, over breakfast. Mm. You know, there was an idea and there was something, and then I went down to the studio and I was like, oh, do you think it's this? And came together. And then it was very quick, which I find a lot of the really good ones are reasonably quick.
Yeah.
Bit of tinkering with the lyrics, but reasonably quick.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And then there's just like bang, 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 da, 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 da.
Was it
and
always then, a duet for Carly and Danny?
It was just written as a song.
Okay.
And then someone in the room, and I don't know who it was because I can't remember, said, oh, this would be good for you to do with your sister. And then cut to 6 months or 4 months later, and the two girls are doing it at the Royal Albert Hall.
Fans all over the world rejoice. That moment when Danny walks on stage at the Royal Albert Hall is really special. When you watch the televised version, you can see the audience looking, going, is she? Is she there? Is she coming out? And the look on their faces when she comes out and joins Kylie is incredible.
But it was amazing. But, I mean, a lot of the other songs, I mean, again, going back to the Britney Spears thing, I mean, I loved writing, there's a song called Breathe On Me, which I loved writing, but I never imagined for a second that, you know, I'm not great at writing to a brief. If someone sends me four songs and says, we need something like this, I was like, well, just go and get those guys then.
Okay.
But as you said earlier on, sometimes it's the ones that you don't expect that are the ones that they want.
Well, because they'll have 100 of those, because that's what they've asked for.
Can I ask you about the Holly Valance song, Hypnotic?
So
was that, so Holly's second album was very much like an electro clash sounding record. Was that a brief that you were writing to?
No, not really. That was done at a friend of mine called Brian Rawlings, who owns a company called Metrophonic. He has a lovely studio out in Surrey. And I wrote that with Steve Lee and the same people I wrote Breathe On Me with and Lisa Green. And they just said, we want something different. And we thought, okay, let's go really, really, really different. And just literally put that together. That was relatively quick. And at that point, I don't even think we'd met Holly, actually. Right. And then she came in and just smashed it out of the park.
Hmm. One of the things I love about you on Twitter is that you often go back over stuff from many years ago that people might have missed the first time round. We have all sorts of titles.
The hidden gems. We love a hidden gem.
We both love a hidden gem. Yeah. We found one mutually. I think Wendy Mahari was the one. We think we're the only two people that might have bought that.
Well, that was amazing. I didn't think anyone in Ailes would actually know that. And of course, I followed your blog for like new music as well, so I didn't know that you had that kind of history existed. So
where I was going to go was there's a few artists that I have always loved that perhaps didn't get the break for whatever reason. So Danielle Gahar was one I really, really love. So I know you did a track with her that I don't think got released.
No, it appeared. There was a whole album with Danny. I saw her recently, actually. She's the most incredible singer. If you love that gorgeous kind of smoky tone, there's a lot of her most recent albums. She made an incredible
jazz
album.
Yeah.
But that was done again at the time in, I imagine, the 90s, where I was virtually living at Psalm West. And
the artist did get a chance, at least, in terms of, I remember her three amazing pop singles all missed the top 40, but they were on the radio a lot, and they sounded like hits.
She was beautiful.
Great girl.
And one of the best singers I've ever worked with in my life. We actually did another song, which was a ballad, which Richard again did. But then she's had an incredible career.
Yeah. Rebecca Ryan is another that
That was the first album that she ever made when she was about 17.
Yeah. Wolfie was behind that. Steve Wolf, wasn't
he?
Yeah, I remember
she
that.
Sounded, she was MCA? Amazing. She's, it was. Yeah, was yeah. MCA. So it's the same, around the same time as you guys. There.
She flitted sounds a bit. So she kind of went down a dance route for a while and later re-emerged with a more acoustic sound.
Did you hear, you ever heard the version? We did a version of a song called Fallen from Pretty Woman.
That's the one I was listening to.
And the thing is, Rebecca, she's this 17-year-old kid from Birmingham who sounded like Barbara Streisand.
Yes, she did. And she did a cover. Woman in Love, didn't she, as well, which was her probably one of her
amazing
own.
Amazing voice.
Yeah.
They put a lot of money into her, didn't they, MCA?
Yeah, they did.
You know, I was really surprised that it didn't go.
And Clive Griffin is another.
Oh, yeah.
He was a great, great
vocalist. I always say that a lot of the people from our generation were so lucky in the fact that there was money around to try things. And I was nearly everyone I work with, well, I say everyone I work with, I'm a fan of. And I'd bought his first album and I'd seen all these names on it that I was a massive fan of, like Richard and stuff. And then I wrote some songs with him, became friends, and he got signed to Sony in America. And I said, will you produce the record? I'd never done anything before, really, apart from one album with Alison Limerick, it was more programmed. And I said, where do you want to do it? And he said, I'm friends with some musicians. Let's do it in America. And I found myself at the age of 21 at a studio in New York called Bearsville with three or four of the best session musicians. You know, it's Nathan East, Greg Fillinger, and Steve Ferrone.
Wow.
And producing this record. So again, I was very lucky that I had a baptism of fire of you plonk in that situation, and if you swim, then you're kind of set up for anything. And the other version of that is one of the first remixes, big remixes I did was the guy that used to run DMC, Tony Prince. He was a friend of Paul McCartney. And there was, when Paul McCartney was doing remixes, he had this thing where he wanted it all to be controlled and he wanted to be part of it. So again, I found myself in his studio at the age of 20 years old. So I think...
Intimidating much?
Do you know what? It genuinely, what it was, half of me was thinking, you know, as I was driving up to it, I was like, God, I wish I could just for a minute just change places with my dad, just so that he could have this.
Yeah, wow, yeah.
But it was, as I find with, and I don't know, Ricky, you might find this as well, with a lot of super, super famous people, they have a really good knack of just making it okay quickly. And I walked to the kitchen, and God bless it, was when Linda was alive, and he just turned around and went, "Hi, I'm Paul, do you want a cuppa?" And that was it.
Yeah.
And I think when we're lucky enough to be around those incredibly famous, if you've met uber famous people and you know that there's no attitude...
Yeah. And don't you find that the more successful they are, the nicer they are?
Yeah.
And it's always the ones that are up and coming that are a little bit difficult.
Well, a bit more to prove.
To prove, definitely.
Yeah. So, I'll always work with, I still work with new artists now. I still work with people that, you know, if I can help or if it's something that I'm, but it's down to, if it's my cup of tea or what I'm good at. I now am quite good at saying no to things that I don't think I'm good at.
Who's pushing your buttons at the moment, Steve?
As far as new artists are concerned?
Yeah,
my favourite new artist of the last 2 years, and I think I'm sure this is going to be her year, is a girl called Maisie Peters, who is only 19. The most incredible songwriter. I saw her show this year. And she's worked with a lot of friends of mine, like John Green and people like that, but she's way wise beyond her 8 years.
My 13-year-old's a big fan.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's weird. I went to see her show with my niece, you know, and it's like, but we both really love her.
Yeah.
And then I got, there's lots of different people. I do tend to do a sort of thing on Twitter, like an Ace New Music thing, and a lot of it comes from his website as well.
Bless you.
There's a few people that I follow. Some of my stuff can be a bit throwback, like new people doing, like you're talking about, you know, the throwbacks. So, I mean, there's a band called Kira who I absolutely adore, who did a Shania Twain cover last year and done. And there was a song called That Will Be a Lie. And it is that slightly electro thing. There's a band called Great Good Fine OK.
Yeah, we like them. They've just done a song called 2020. I think it's the first song I've seen called 2020.
Yeah, I like it when the production value is good.
Do you like The Midnight? Because we're huge fans of The Midnight.
Oh, my God, absolutely. Mm. But then that's what I'm saying. It's almost like... It could be then.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But again,
we went and saw them in London, and they were just missed absolutely
that. Good songs as well, right?
Great songs.
It's not just fluff and electronica. Yeah. You know, America 2 is a really great song.
The singer
and,
as well,
and
he's
and the sax
incredible
on there. It's just really fresh. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where we met Nina. Of course.
We did.
Ah, cool.
Yeah. So
Ricky has worked on her new album.
Oh, amazing!
That's we've done a couple
great
of tracks.
That's of
brilliant.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart. She comes up with her partner Laura Fares.
Yeah,
and so the three of us have written a couple of tracks together.
Fantastic!
And I'm hoping that they're going to come up and do some more stuff. I think they're up for it.
So yeah.
we'll see how that goes. But I can't wait to hear that when it's all finished and done.
I like quality. I like unapologetic people that just really, really mean it. And I think, you know, the whole New Music Friday thing, there was this thing that I think I saw on Facebook this morning, which was some writers saying about they have to write a certain way because of the attention span, and it all has to be this and it all has to be that. And I was like, I don't think so, because I'm about longevity. I always say that longevity over trending. Mm. But I like a song that's going to still be around in 10, 15 years, not one that's going to be forgotten in 10, 15 weeks or replaced with its next version.
Yeah.
And I think in general, the public are too, because, you know, it's reflected, whether it's Adele or Sam Smith or, you know, or Ed Sheeran or something, you know, there are copyright songs there that will still be being played in 15, 20
definitely
years.
Definitely.
And there's just cool fluff that's just going to go.
How do you make the segue that you did from, you know, production and remixing to becoming a musical director? How does that evolution happen?
Again, I got thrown in at the deep end. We finished the Kylie album, Impossible Princess had come out, and it had not done very well, apart from in Australia. And it was very, I mean, people may forget, but at that time there was all these headlines, you know, Kylie career over, everything like that. So she said, oh, we're going to go and do 7 shows in Australia, this show that we called Intimate and Live. And her creative director, or even wasn't then, the guy, her stylist at the time, William Baker, and I were working with her. And she said, right, come over, we're doing a tour. And we sat on a plane, looked at each other and went, I haven't got a clue what I'm doing. And he looked at me and said, no, I don't know what I'm doing, but maybe she should sing Dancing Queen. And I learned how to put a tour together in Australia.
Wow. That's incredible.
And I've always been very thankful of the fact that we learned. It was almost like we learned from the ground up. So as her career went back, the shows got bigger. So I learned how to do a theatre show, then a bigger theatre show, then an arena show, then an arena spectacular, amazing, then the Olympics. You know what I mean? So,
also, you didn't have the technology that we have these days, you know, like with Ableton and
oh, no, it was all samplers.
So that's a lot of work.
But you must have done programming. Yeah, but I mean, you remember what that was like when you had like a stack of samplers up. And
What shows have you been the most nervous for of all the really big stuff? What ones have really... Because I'm thinking of huge things like Commonwealth Games and big Hyde Park stuff. It's pretty daunting stuff.
I suppose so. Nervousness. I think at the beginning I was very nervous because I was kind of learning what I was doing. I'm never nervous around her because she will, no matter what happens, she will always pull it off. I think there were some technical aspects of Aphrodite, which is the show we did with water.
Gosh, with the water, yeah.
That was, wow. We weren't quite sure, and there were some things there. But I weirdly don't, because the thing about the difference between me and Ricky is that he's a musical director on stage. You know, I'm not on stage. So a lot of my prep starts 5 months before we rehearse. And then I'm in the rehearsals and then in the production rehearsals. So literally by show one, it kind of is.
It's there.
I have a list of things that need to be fixed or that people want me to fix. Mm. Once that list goes down to zero, I'm done because I signed the show off. So I think, and also once you do one of those big shows, like the first really big one was the Sydney Olympics. I think once you've done one, you think, well, actually, when
I've
you go back
it
to.
Off.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this, and also it's, if it's live, it's sort of out of your hands.
How did you approach Glastonbury last year?
That was...
There must have been a fair amount riding on that for Kylie in terms of, obviously, it was a real, you know, going full circle from meant to be doing it, was obviously really unwell, couldn't do it, and then getting the chance to do it again. Was there a different pressure on that show?
We couldn't even really call it Glastonbury. We kept calling it the short show because we had a... we had two shows. She was doing a greatest hits sort of tour of beautiful castles and stuff like that. And the Glastonbury was 75 minutes. So we called it the short show. And Rob Sinclair, who's a creative director now, had just said, we just need to celebrate, basically. It has to be a massive, massive celebration. And we just prepped and prepped and prepped and prepped and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed for all we could do. But Glastonbury... as with any festival shows that that you would have done, is what they call a plug and play show. So there's no sound check. You just go, plug in, hope. So, you know, for that show I was, you know, and also the same thing is with the BBC guys that mix it. It's what whoever you get, you get, and they are hearing it for the first time. And
did you get to enjoy it?
I got to enjoy. We had a few sound issues on the day, which we were able to fix for. They just re-showed it at Christmas, actually, on Christmas Day. And we were able to. We had a few really boring stuff, like we were using like Kempers for the guitars.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's some line level stuff that this is all nerdy stuff, but it's the line level stuff went down. And there's a problem with it. There's a few things that didn't quite. It took a little while for it to settle.
Yeah.
So I was pleased we could readdress it. So actually, if I'm honest, when I was in the moment, I was more concerned about how can we like get this to sound the best it could.
Yes, yeah. It's always the first two or three numbers, isn't it?
That
you're just like,
yeah, you know, front of house in. Was fine because we had all that. We had our front of house guy, so in the thing, it was fine. Yeah. But as so often with these incredibly massive shows and life-changing shows, I'm sat at the back in a little caravan with someone.
Yeah.
So
how much did Kylie love it? Because she looked like she absolutely loved it.
I think it's better to refer you to her on that, because I think she said quite a bit about that. But it was amazing. I mean, what I think it did was it almost punched a hole in an audience that you think that you've reached everyone. But it seemed to me that after Glastonbury, there were people who wouldn't have normally said it, who'd have gone, God, she's pretty good, isn't she?
She's good, isn't she? Yeah.
And
it was just so joyful. That's the one I was... Well, that's what we were watching it back, I just thought it was pure joy.
But I think when you're part of a creative team, it's very easy to look at the five little things that went wrong and not the 95% of it that went absolutely, that couldn't have gone better.
And those five things, nobody noticed.
Nobody
anyway.
Noticed.
Yeah.
So...
But yeah, you're right. They're the ones that after a show, if there's any mistakes, I'm the one that's picked up on it.
Yeah.
And so, well, what happened there? It's just how did you notice that?
But she smashed it. I mean, my God, she really couldn't have been more proud. I mean, the way that her performance now is, it's the best it's ever been, and it's always been good. But her, as a live performer now, it's...
But Kim's the same, I think. I think Kim is an incredible live performer now. Not that she wasn't, but the confidence and the vocal, everything.
I don't think it's
being
comfortable as well.
It only comes with doing more. You
experience.
Know, doing so many gigs and experience, yeah. So I think that's where Kim is. She just loves it so much now that it's a part of her life, you know, the touring. Whereas in the old days, it was just doing the odd TV and recording.
Yeah,
it wasn't so much a big thing. But probably over the last 15 years, I think it's just got. It's really important part of our lives.
But also, I imagine she's probably fallen back in love with songs that maybe 15 years ago, she's like, God, not that again.
Yeah.
You kind of find your original love again.
And falling in love with performing.
Yeah.
I think she took about 10 years out, you know, like quite a long time.
Yeah.
And she kind of fell out of love with the whole industry.
Which is like Rick. Rick did the same. Rick Astley did the same thing, didn't he?
Exactly. And it happens a lot, you know. It's not unusual, and I can honestly say that she's enjoying her life and her music, and her performing more than she ever has, you know. And,
but she also has what I call an embarrassment of riches as far as songs is concerned.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like, oh, here's my two songs. You know, there's a lot there.
But the same with the Kylie thing. You can see that she's really comfortable where she is, and you can see in her head she's sorted, you know, she's kind of there.
Well, that's it. I mean, the second song of Glastonbury was the original version of I Should Be So Lucky. And she was just like, I wasn't going to make you wait for that one. And it's just like, let's do it. Let's embrace it.
Yeah. It was an incredible set. I really, really enjoyed it. I've watched it multiple times back.
Got some lovely comments.
It was. How do you, you know, so there's lots of talk about another Kylie album coming, and in an interview she used three words, grown-up disco was mentioned.
Apparently,
in your head, do you start to think already in terms of, right, okay, grown-up disco, what's that going to look like as a tour? Do you wait until...
No, because it might not be that.
Okay.
You know, Golden wasn't country originally.
No.
There was a whole album of stuff that wasn't
that isn't
golden,
country, absolutely.
Or that got goldenified.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Speak.
Yeah.
So no, I kind of very much deal with what's on the table at the time.
Yeah.
So who knows what it'll be?
Yeah.
And once it exists and everyone's on board, you know, I will kind of find out.
If you're responsible, well done for getting Lost Without You onto the Golden Tour.
That's Kylie. That's her, one of her favourites. I mean, that's the first song I heard from Golden before it had almost gone country. And I just literally, I said, that is your Coldplay song. That's your...
It's my favourite
That
song
is your
on that album.
Glastonbury song. Mm. With John Green, who's one of my favourite writers. And, it had to... Oh, God. I mean, it's still one of my favourite Kylie songs ever, let alone on that album.
Yeah. Absolutely, it's a winner. That's something I wanted to ask in terms of, is there a bigger name that you kind of think, I wish I'd had a chance to do?
I don't know. I don't know about bigger. I mean, beginning of last year, I tend to do a lot more shows than records now, but I still love making records. And I made a record last year with a friend of mine from years ago, who's a now an actor called Luke Evans.
Luke Evans, yeah.
Who was, when I, the first musical I ever musical directed was Rent, and he was Roger in Rent then in 2007.
So, Siobhan Donaghy in that?
Yes, Siobhan was in it, yeah, and Denise Van Outen. And I kind of, we met, and I just, this is how these things come about, you know. I just said, oh, he'd done something the previous year. He's an amazing singer, and he's a friend. And I said, oh, you should make a record. We just did three demos. Someone liked it, and we ended up making a record. And so that's kind of
and
how.
And he's going on tour with it, isn't he?
He's going on
well?
Tour in April, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a pretty tour-wise, it's a pretty busy year.
Are you doing the Louise tour?
I'm doing Louise.
Oh, I'm coming to Cambridge, I hope, so yes. I'll be at that
Yeah,
one.
And again, it's a lot of people that are, for that kind of audience, you know, Westlife is, I'm MD for Westlife as well. They're back doing stadiums this year. A lot of people that I've worked with before, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, that are still in the same way as the 80s kind of guys.
It's and like, coming back stronger.
Yeah, I mean, Westlife have sold out Wembley Stadium.
Incredible.
And I mean,
it'll definitely sell out. It's
exactly.
Not even a question mark over it.
And even like the 90s, like Steps, I MD'd their last tour and they're back this year. And so, you know, there's lots of fun stuff. But I don't know about people that I tend to find a lot of the people that I really love, I don't want to work with.
Okay.
Because I think I really love them. And I just want to love them as an artist.
Yeah, yeah. Don't want it to become work.
Yeah, unless I've got a really good idea and say, oh, let's try to do this. So I tend to turn down a lot more, not because I'm great or busy, but I normally, to my manager's absolute pet hate, I'm normally the first person when someone calls and says, oh, you don't want me, you want this person because they'd do it better.
Mm. Oh, wow.
So, but who knows? I can't believe that we're still able to do this anyway.
It's incredible, isn't it? All these years later, we were like saying earlier on, where we had a meeting down the pub. How many years ago was that?
Well, that was whenever Can't Get Enough of Your Love was
1990. Yeah.
There you go. He knows. Amazing, we don't know.
So all but these years later, we're
get
still
to,
here doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we
know?
Get to still do it. And
fabulous.
It's incredible. Yeah, we're really, really lucky. And yeah. I would say for, you know, anyone listening is, I think it's, in a way, it's a lot easier now to get started because you've got the laptop and you can
I was going to say
upload
this.
Stuff.
What advice would you give to any budding songwriter?
Well, I think it's easier, but I think it's harder because there's so much more out there.
Yes. Content is
so
just overwhelming each week.
I just think do a lot and surround yourself with people that can be honest.
Yes.
You know, don't have
surround yourself with people that understand you and understand what you're about and listen to what you're doing.
And, you know, there's a reason why Billie Eilish is successful is because nobody said to Billie Eilish, oh, you need to sound like Billie Eilish.
Yeah.
It was just her and her brother mucking around on a computer in a bedroom. Mm. So I think
that's a lovely thing as well, the brother sister thing.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah.
I'll look at that. And
that can work.
It's
and
a lovely
also
thing.
And also just, you know, I'd say don't try and take your influence. If you're taking influences, don't take it from the last 5 years. Mm. Take it from the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Don't try and sound like what's out now, because by the time it's out, it will be completely wrong. So, you know, listen to, I'm not saying go back to the 80s necessarily, but find things from, learn history. Spotify is great in which that you can recommend you stuff from, as we were talking before we said this, you know, your kids and stuff have got 80s, 90s, 2000s, 70s, 60s maybe songs on their playlist. So don't just refine yourself. Being relevant and contemporary is not all about sounding like what's on the radio now or what's streaming now.
Absolutely. So. That's good advice.
Beautiful.
That's all I'd say.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for
thank
coming.
You. Thank
it's
you
been
both.
An honour. Thank
it's
you
been
so much.
Lovely.
Thank you.
It's so lovely to see you again.
Well, lovely to see you. And lovely to finally meet you after following
you.
Your... I literally have... There's only... I've said this before. There's only... I've got three go-to blogs that I look at every Saturday when I do my Ice New Music, and yours is there. So
bless you. You're
so
very
keep
kind.
Up the good work yourself.
Thank
well,
you.
Man.
It's very sweet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as we said earlier, the more successful they are, the nicer they are. And it couldn't be true when it comes to Steve Anderson. My God, that man, he's worked with so many different people, done all there is to do in the industry. And after, when we turned the microphones off, he was telling us about some of the projects that he's going to be working on. And my God, we were there open-mouthed. So I can't go into that, but watch this space. Amazing guy.
Anyway, thank you so much again, Steve. Absolute legend. Please join us next week where we will be chatting to some more unsung heroes. Have a great week and I will see you then. You have been listening to Unsung Heroes with me, Ricky Wilde, Jake Wood and Lee Bennett. Produced and created by myself and Jake Wood for Wildwood Productions. With music and editing, again by myself, Ricky Wilde. Artwork by Scarlett Wilde and hosted by Acast. Just to remind you that there is a link in the notes directing you to a Spotify playlist featuring all the songs we have discussed in this episode. Many thanks for listening.
Unsung Heroes.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.